Hey, everybody. Welcome back to From Complex to Queens, Amazing Avenue's Minor League Podcast. I'm Steve Saipa, and I'm joined by Lucas Vlahos and Cam Levin. How you guys doing?
All right.
Yeah, feeling good.
All right, so Passover is this week, and despite all the stereotypes, some of them legit anti-Semitic tropes, and then some of them kind of good-natured, self-depreciating humor, the history of Jewish people in baseball, it goes back a while. All the immigrants from like the early 1900s, you know, it was kind of a rite of passage almost to become American by understanding and following baseball. And then the children of those immigrants became, you know, some of the greats, you know, Hank Greenberg, Sandy Koufax. And since then, there have been plenty of Jews in baseball. And, you know, a few stars here and there, but mostly journeymen and unspectacular players. And that's what made the success of Team Israel in the 2017 World Baseball Classic so crazy, is that they were just basically a bunch of schlubs, and they beat South Korea, Taiwan, the Netherlands, and they played an extremely competitive game against Cuba. And those are some of the best baseball, you know, countries in the world. So the Mets have had a few of those Team Israel players in their minor leagues. So who are we going to promote, extend, or trade? Or, I guess, in the spirit of Passover, who are we going to shtup, who are we going to plots, and who are we going to schlep?
We have to Ty Dally. Give us definitions of each of those, please.
Well, when you shtup someone, you really like them.
Okay, and then, okay.
Yeah, when you plots over someone, you like them also in a different way, though.
Okay.
And then when you're going to schlep these guys.
Yeah, the schlep one makes sense. Yeah.
So we have Ty Kelly, we have Ike Davis, and we have Zach Thornton, who ironically was the guy that Ike was traded for.
Huh. Zach Thornton. Oh, I remember him.
Left-handed starting pitcher and got converted to relief. Yep.
Yeah. Not good. But
yeah.
I caused so much pain and misery and disappointment that I think I have to schlep him.
Mm-hmm.
Nothing against him personally, but that was a roller coaster of a career.
Yeah, I got so tired of the Ike versus Duda conversation towards the end that, like, nothing against Ike, but I really don't want to talk about him ever again.
I agree.
Like, that conversation went on, like, a year too long.
Yep. It was the Shortstop Avenue audio before Shortstop Avenue audio.
Pretty much, yeah.
I already forgot the other two words, but I'm going to take Ty Kelly as the one I really like and Thornton as the one I like, but less so. Let's go with that.
Yeah, I agree with that. Ty Kelly's Twitter game is very fun. He's also a switch hitter, so that's cool. Has some versatility. He's going to play for a while, if not always on a big league roster, just because of those reasons. So, yeah,
Did he get time on the 2015 team? I don't remember if it was that year or the year.
2016.
2016, right, yeah.
And then he was in the minors all year, I think, for 2018.
Yeah, because 2017 he was with the Phillies, right?
Yes. Think,
yeah. All right, well, sounds good. And that will conclude the ethnic portion of this podcast. Back to regular stuff now. Syracuse Mets, they went 5-2, and they are 14-9 for the season, which puts them two games behind the Lehigh Valley Iron Pigs for first place in the International League North. The Binghamton Rumble Ponies went 3-2, and they are 10-7 for the year, which is just one game behind the Trenton Thunder for first in the Eastern League Eastern Division. St. Lucie Mets went 4-2, and that puts them at 13-10 for the season, which is three games behind the Palm Beach Cardinals for first place in the FSL South. And finally, the Columbia Fireflies, they had a terrible week. They went 1-5, and they are now a very disappointing 8-14 for the season. But somehow, I guess it's because it's only the end of April, but they're just 3 games behind the Greenfield Drive for first place in the South Atlantic League Southern Division. So, I mean, if they have a string of a couple of good games and Greenville has a couple of bad games, all of a sudden they're right back in the conversation. Now our hitter of the week, and that is Syracuse Mets infielder Danny Espinosa. He played in 6 games this week, and he hit 375, 423, 750 with 3 doubles and 2 home runs, and stolen base to boot. So for anyone who's not familiar with Espinosa, he's been a major leaguer. He's a veteran. He was drafted by the Nationals in the 3rd round of the 2008 draft out of Cal State Long Beach. And the Nats were a little aggressive with him. They pushed him hard, and he was in major leagues by 2010 as a September call-up, and then 2011 as his first full season. And that year he hit 236, 323, 414 with 21 homers and 17 stolen bases, which was actually good for 6th in National League Rookie of the Year conversation. Craig Kimbrell won that year. He got all the votes, all the first place votes. And Espinosa really never really reached those heights again. And because the average is so low and on base is kind of I guess it's kind of hard to say that those numbers were a high. But at the same time, he did basically have a 2020 season, and he has some utility at shortstop. So I don't want to take that away from the guy, but his best wasn't really that great. And he spent the next couple of years in the Nats infield, either at short or at second, until 2016, because that winter they got Adam Eaton, which meant that they were going to shift Trey Turner back into the infield, which meant that Espinosa was the odd man out. So he got traded to the Angels in exchange for Austin Adams and Kyle McGowan, and his tenure there was pretty short. It started off with a bang because his first hit was a game-winning homer, but he ended up hitting 162, 237, 276 in 77 games. And he was designated for assignment and then eventually released late in the summer. The Mariners and the Rays both took gambles on him down the stretch, but he didn't really do anything of importance for either team. And then he bounced around the minors in 2018. He signed with the Yankees over the winter, and then he played for the Blue Jays, the Dodgers, and the Phillies at different points during the season. And then he signed with the Mets this winter. And his time in Syracuse has definitely been better than his time in Buffalo, Lehigh Valley, or Oklahoma City last year. Maybe it's because of the, you know, quote-unquote juice AAA ball. Maybe it's because he learned a trick or two when he was playing in Mexico over the winter. Maybe it's just statistical noise over the first month of the season. Who knows? But despite the numbers, the good numbers so far, Espinosa definitely has an uphill battle when it comes to possible MLB playing time. The Mets' infield, it's already crowded with Cano, McNeil, Rosario, Frazier, soon Jed Lowry, and then add Luis Guillorme and Adany Echevarria to the mix as other possible AAA guys that could see MLB playing time. And it's hard to see any kind of real path to the majors for Espinosa. Do you guys have any thoughts about him?
I'm honestly surprised any infielder signed with any minor league infielder signed with the Mets this offseason, given how deep the major league infield is. And where are you looking at on this team and saying, yeah, I could get to the majors? It had to go pretty wrong.
I was looking over details of his contract, checking to see if it was one of those things where he was given the option of, you know, dropping it after a certain amount of time, but I couldn't find anything. So, unless he asks for his release and the Mets grant it, it seems pretty stuck.
Yeah.
I'm just going to say that I think Danny Espinosa probably didn't have too many options, given the fact that he spent pretty much all of 2018 in AAA,
That's fair. So I'm curious what you guys think, because off the top of my head, I thought Danny Espinosa, man, he used to kill the Mets. What do you guys think without checking?
That's actually very true, because when I was looking at his stats, I remember saying to myself, like, wow, this guy is not very good. And I remember him not necessarily being hyped on, like, Twitter and, you know, just online, but I remember him being a lot better than his numbers actually were, and that probably has become because he was a Met killer.
And he wasn't actually a Met killer. He wasn't even that good against the Mets. He hit 227, 309, 353. That's scrolling 97 OPS plus per Baseball Reference. It's like not that.
How many dingers though?
No, that's the thing. Let's see. Dingers. Seven dingers in 312 at-bats. Not insane.
Not either. A ton. Yeah. I was going to say that maybe the recency bias is because that's kind of all he does is hit dingers.
I mean, the Nats also just always beat the Mets for like a 2 or 3 year stretch. So we all have PTSD from that. he was also like, him and Desmond was like their Duda versus Ike for a while as to. Who should be their shortstop?
That's wild.
Desmond won that. Anyway, that's enough about Danny Espinosa.
Yeah,
in 2019.
That's a lot of attention for Danny Espinosa in 2019.
He's had a pretty good career. Pretty good run.
Yeah. Our pitcher of the week is a guy who, God willing, you know, another 10 years from now will be someone that we're still talking about, and that is Anthony Kay. This week he started 2 games, and he pitched 11.1 innings, giving up 5 hits, 1 run, walking 5, and striking out 17, which is good for a 79 ERA for the week. So, for those who don't know, Kay was selected 31st overall in the 2016 draft. He was a left-hander out of UConn, and even though he had a fantastic season with them, he posted a 2.65 ERA in 119 innings, and generally was a good collegiate pitcher. He had a cumulative 2.64 ERA in 286 innings, which is a lot for a college pitcher, and it will become actually pretty relevant in a couple of minutes. But despite the good numbers, the Mets were interested in Kay before 2016. He was born and raised in Stony Brook and went to Ward Melville High School, which is the same high school that Steven Matz went to. And just like Matz, Kay set all kinds of records, 27 actually. And basically, the Mets were looking to strike gold twice from the same place, and they drafted Kay in the 29th round of the 2013 draft. They offered him a 6-figure deal, but Kay didn't take it. He went to college instead. And fast forward 2016, and with the compensation pick that the Mets had when Daniel Murphy went to Nats, they picked Kay. He didn't sign until very late. He was actually one of the last high profile draftees to sign with the team before the July 15th deadline, with a slot value of $1,972,000, he agreed to an underslot deal for just over $1 million, and it is believed that it took so long to sign him, and he signed for so quote unquote little, is because of concerns that showed up in his elbow during the physical. That he had with the Mets. Specifically, x-rays showed some fraying in his UCL that might necessitate Tommy John. And sure enough, in October that year, he underwent Tommy John surgery. So he missed the entire 2017 season, but his recovery was without setbacks, and he made his professional debut last year. He began the season with the Columbia Fireflies and posted a very underwhelming 4.54 ERA in 69 innings. And then when he was promoted to St. Lucie midseason, he did a little better there. He pitched 53 innings, and he posted a 3.88 ERA. So he's on the smaller side, and he really maximizes his delivery to get every ounce of velocity that he can. There's some effort in his arm action, but he does use his lower half well, and, you know, there aren't any major injury red flags or anything like that. The fastball hits in the low 90s. It can top out as high as about 95 or so, and it does get some sink and some arm side run, and he's able to command the pitch well. And then looking at his secondaries, coming out of UConn, he threw a changeup and a curveball, with the changeup being the much better of the two, about an above-average pitch or so. It sat in the low 80s with some fade and tumble, and then the curveball was about a below-average pitch because it was a very slurvy kind of high 70s 11-5 curve. Since going professional, you know, and then pitching last season, the order of those two pitches hasn't changed, but the effectiveness of the changeup has taken a step back or two. In college, he kind of telegraphed the pitch a lot, but he was still able to get that arm side action on it. Last season, the changeup was very firm. It didn't really have that much fade to it, and it didn't look like a pitch that could be considered above average. So it's only been a handful of starts, and we're still in April in the cold, rainy Northeast, so it's hard to get a gauge as to whether or not the numbers that he's put up so far are just, you know, some relatively small sample noise, or if there's been a real development in either the curveball or the changeup. I know Lucas has some very strong feelings about Kay. Has his month now of putting up good numbers changed your opinion of him any?
No, I mean my opinions about Kay are mostly about the process that went into drafting him. Like, if Kay was a fourth round pick, I'd be like, yeah, this is a marginally interesting prospect. It's just the taking a guy who was so heavily abused with such low upside in basically the first round is my problem with Kay. I mean, I want to ask you guys, since I haven't actually watched him and I'm not sure that I'd be the most qualified person if I did, have you guys seen any of his starts this season? Like, do you think the stuff has improved? Because, I mean, I guess he's had a pretty age-appropriate or experience-appropriate level. It's not like they have him in rookie ball blowing away 18-year-olds. So the strikeouts are interesting, but I am concerned by the relatively high walk rate, right? Like, if he can't maintain this kind of strikeout rate, which no one has ever projected him to do, walking this many guys is really problematic. So if he's going to walk that many, it's interesting to me if the strikeouts are for real, and I don't know that we have enough data or enough in-person looks to say that they are real yet.
So I was fairly impressed with him in spring. The curveball looks a lot better than it did as an amateur. I saw a few starts of him at UConn, and Steve's report on him, you know, the changeup being more advanced than the curveball was definitely true then. It was very slurvy, kind of like a loopy breaking pitch that wouldn't have worked at present in affiliated ball. That being said, it really took a big step forward last year, and maybe even – I don't know if it's taken an additional step forward, but I think it's like an above-average offering now, or at least flashes above average. So that's really why I went from very low on K to, hey, maybe he's a reliever, like a good reliever.
Sure. Where does he – did you see what his general approach was? Like, is he someone who wants to keep the ball down, or is he more of a fly ball guy? What's his, like, where's he throwing in the zone usually?
Let's see. He is able to go all over, and he does get, if I'm not mistaken, a pretty high ground ball rate.
Because I remember reading at some point that in the minors, very often high strikes aren't called. So if he was a guy who was working up in the zone, I might be less concerned about the walk rate. I might also be totally wrong on that, but I'm pretty sure I could not cite the article, but I'm pretty sure that's what it said.
Yeah, I think I know what you're referring to. I think it was a Baseball America article.
Yeah.
About him having a high spin fastball, which I don't know if that's, you know, actually true or not, but, he's been like a fly ball pitcher this year. He's at a 48.1%, obviously like a small sample, especially when you're talking about batted ball data.
Yeah,
but
absolutely.
I don't know. He's appeared to me, and I'm not really sure if this is true or not, but just to my, you know, Like, I've seen him throw, I think, like 2 or 3 starts this year, and in spring, he throws a lot of fastballs.
Mm-hmm.
I'm thinking that he may get a lot more swings and misses if he leans on the curve a little harder.
Okay.
But again, I'm probably too high on his curveball, so.
I mean, I'm always skeptical of, and I think this is a generally accepted truism that anybody with a good changeup in the minors is going to look better than they actually are, because mm-hmm. everyone in the minors has never seen a good changeup and just flails wildly.
Yeah.
So if he was still a fastball changeup guy and was putting up these kind of numbers, I'd be even less high on him. But mm-hmm. if he's doing this with the breaking ball that looks plus or flashes plus, whatever, that's encouraging to me.
He's definitely improved, I think, mm-hmm. Over the last – basically since coming back from Tommy John. He's definitely looked better than I thought he would when he was drafted.
Do you think the changeup has taken a step back, or is it just that he's not using it as much now?
I've talked to Jeff about this, and it's apparently a pretty well-documented thing that changeup command is often something that goes away after Tommy John surgery.
I could buy that. Like, it's not an easy pitch to throw, and et cetera, et cetera.
Requires a lot of, you know, feel and has to come off the hand right.
Yep.
So, I don't know.
I mean, I could definitely buy that. And look, if you're right about his curveball, and let's mm-hmm. give him the benefit of the doubt and say he can regain his changeup with more time between surgery and I would say like the change was at least average and borderline plus coming out of college. That's an intriguing pitch mix then.
Yep.
Like that's a start.
Give him 3 at least average pitches, which you need to succeed.
Yeah. Yeah. With fine velocity for a lefty. So.
Yeah. Steve, can I pat you on the back for good scouting?
if you want to, sure.
Yeah, so I'm looking at Anthony K's draft write-up, and you said of his curveball, the key to this pitch's development is K's wrist. He generally mm-hmm. releases the pitch with a stiff wrist. If the left-hander is able to loosen and turn over his wrist when he releases the pitch, he'll be able to generate more break on the ball. I forget where I read this, but I think that's exactly what happened with him.
Hmm.
So, good job,
Steve. I was 3 years in the future 3 years ago.
Steve in 2016, Steve living in 2019, and none of us knew it. I mean, I always find that interesting, the Tommy John recovery guys, and I find it interesting in other sports where you miss significant time as well. Do you, like, go back to the drawing board a lot, like, revisit fundamentals that might have slipped over the years, and perhaps you come back better, especially with how good training staffs and strength and conditioning staffs are these days? So, I mean, that's a really interesting tidbit that he basically relearned or greatly fixed his curveball coming back from Tommy John.
So much coaching and everything has come so far since, you know, even the, let's say, the last decade or so, all that stuff has come so far with training staffs and whatever else.
Mm-hmm.
It's definitely interesting stuff.
I mean, go ahead, Ken.
I was going to say, I kind of feel like you have to treat them as two different pitchers, you know, pre-Tommy John and post.
Sure.
Based on, you know, how much noise gets introduced when you take a year off of baseball, you know? So I think it's generally encouraging that some of the good things with K showed up again. And there were some weird developments that make him mildly interesting. I think that's fair to say.
Right.
It's actually interesting that you say that we need to treat players coming back from Tommy John as completely different guys. Because, I mean, thinking about it, for just me at least, when I think of a guy like Kay, who doesn't have, like, an outstanding fastball, I don't really think of it in terms like that. But yet, when we were looking at Zapucki or Marcos Molina, that is exactly how we always were. We always had to denote everything with before Tommy John and then after Tommy John. That's mm-hmm. actually an interesting
mm-hmm. little thing. That's a
good
point. Yeah. Yeah, I think they're the extreme examples. Not everybody, you know, looks quite as different. But I think that's kind of a good way to think about it, generally.
I think a lot of it is also polish. Like, you expect guys with polish to retain the knowledge they have, right? Maybe, yeah. Maybe you want to call it maturity, whatever term you want to give it. You That's assume true. That they're not going to forget all the lessons they've learned versus the guys who are raw stuff like Molina and Sapucki, which is to take nothing away from their knowledge of baseball, just they have less experience. So you, if they're someone who relies on pure stuff, that feels more important. It feels more important to denote the pre and post Tommy John side of things. I mean, look, at this point, Kay has not all at the same time, but at various points in his career flashed every tool he needs to be not just a back-end starter, but perhaps a mid-rotation starter.
Mm-hmm.
And that's already an improvement to me over what he was drafted as and what I honestly expected coming back from Tommy John. So
he's looking like a mild organizational success so far, you know?
I mean, at this point, he's what, like 10th on the starting pitching depth chart? I think we had this conversation about Harrell last week, but like...
I think you can make a very good argument that he's probably the best pitching prospect in the org right now. Considering Colome is hurt, Peterson is, you know...
Whatever.
Peterson, yeah. all of this being said, and I know I'm very high on Kay's curveball, I don't know if it's an out pitch. I just want to say that. I think it's probably closer to above average than, like, you know, a legit, like, plus offering. So,
I mean, I might be totally off base here, but it sounds like the arsenal we're describing is not mm-hmm. totally dissimilar from Steven Matz in 2019.
Oh, yeah.
And that's a Mike Moustakas homer aside, solid pitcher.
Oh, yeah, that's a guy who you're okay with being in your rotation, you know?
Yep. If you have an offense that can score 6 runs a game, that's great.
Steven Matz minus is not a bad outcome here.
Not at all.
All right. Well, that was a very hearty discussion about Anthony Kay. And we will be back after this.
Beyonce, Ariana Grande, and Drake are talked about ad nauseum as celebrities, but there's one thing that's rarely discussed. Their music.
On Switched on Pop, we go deep into the sounds of pop music to explain what it means, how it's made, and why it's so effective.
We talk with some of today's greatest artists, producers, and journalists to decode the musical logic behind our modern soundtrack and understand its role in our culture.
Switched on Pop will reveal for you how a secretive Swedish producer is behind many of the top 10 hits of the past 20 years.
And we'll uncover the ways that songwriters embed their political activism into today's most popular tracks.
We'll show you the surprising musical similarities between Cardi B and Taylor Swift.
And we'll even dive into the classical past to hear how the Jonas Brothers mirror Mozart's youthful party days.
I'm songwriter Charlie Harding.
And I'm musicologist Nate Sloan.
Join us on a journey through the world of popular music by subscribing to Switched on Pop on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or your favorite podcast app to get new episodes every Tuesday.
Hey everybody, I'm Neil I. Patel, editor-in-chief of The Verge, and this is The Vergecast. Vergecast is the flagship podcast of The Verge. Every week we cover the latest in tech news and reviews. We take a critical look at what is going on now and next in the world of tech. The show is hosted by me, our executive editor, Dieter Bohn.
Not your friend.
And Paul Miller.
It just feels like there's something wrong with all computers, though. Don't you think that sometimes?
We do that on Fridays, and on Tuesdays we have an interview episode. I've been talking to all kinds of influential people in and around the world of tech. We talked to Microsoft founder Bill Gates about his philanthropic efforts.
You can design systems without having to reveal any individuals for particular medical record.
Journalists and academics like Lena Khan, who thinks that we should be doing way more to break up giant companies like Amazon and Facebook.
I think in hindsight, allowing Facebook to buy up both WhatsApp and Instagram proved to have been the wrong call.
And we talked to tech CEOs like Vizio's Bill Baxter, who explained exactly how smart TV manufacturers make their money.
It's about post-purchase monetization of the TV.
It's ads. Check us out every Friday to hear about everything in tech, from new iPhone leaks to breaking down Facebook's ongoing issues of privacy to just me and Paul ranting at each other about the role of the government. And check us out on Tuesdays when I host the interview episode. Subscribe to The Vergecast wherever podcasts are served. We'll see you then.
Welcome back, everybody. I'm Steve Saipa, and I'm joined by Lucas Lajos and Ken Lavin. And we'll pick up with that discussion about Kay. And we're going to talk about some trends that the Mets have become known for over the last couple of years, specifically how quickly or how slowly they've been to promote minor league players. So what do you guys think?
I think our stance is on the Mets' previous developmental decisions are pretty well known at this point. Like slow molasses level slow would probably still be giving them too much credit for previous promotion practices.
Yeah, I will never be able to forget David Peterson just carving up Sally League hitters for like way, way, way too long.
Yeah,
like, look, he legit looked like Andrew Miller against them.
A guy like Peterson, there's no reason for him to have been starting in Columbia.
Yeah.
Even the kind of early phantom injury, whatever it was aside, I mean, you could have started him in St. Lucie.
I mean, he was legit, like, what, this one of the top five college pitchers in baseball that season?
That
might be overselling him a touch.
And we're talking about, you know, he was in the Pac-12, which is a very good conference and probably a higher level of competition, you know, across the board than the Sally League.
Yep.
Like, you're facing the, like, less refined D1 hitters from worse conferences than the Pac-12. No reason for him to be there. But no. You know, we've covered that pretty extensively.
Well, this year the Mets have been a little more aggressive. I mean, look at basically half of the roster of Columbia. They're struggling a little bit right now, but, you know, guys like Vientos, guys like Simeon Woods Richardson, guys like Mauricio, Juan Uriarte, a lot of these guys, Shrevon Newton, a lot of these guys, you know, a year or two ago, you'd have said, you know, Brooklyn is going to be loaded. Now we're saying Columbia is loaded.
Brooklyn must win. Yeah, I mean, this is a really drastic change in philosophy. And I actually got to ask Sandy this question at one of the various meetups they did at one point, I think in 2017. And the answer, like, there wasn't a really – and I'm sure it's also him, like, trying to obfuscate their actual strategy. But the answer is very unsatisfying. It's like, we have certain benchmarks that guys have to hit, and if they don't hit them, they don't get to be promoted, which just felt so draconian and rigid for no real reason. Like, every prospect is different. There's no reason that Jeff McNeil needs to get 150 at bats at a certain level. There's no reason Stephen Valines needs to get 20 innings at a certain level. Yep. And it seems like, to the new front office's credit, they've moved past this.
Yeah, they're definitely being a little more prescriptive, you know.
Yeah. Now at the same time, you don't want to pull an Omar and push people way, way, way too fast, like starting Henry Mejia in the majors in. What year was that? I think I was
10,
like,
I think.
I think
nine.
I was like 13.
What was he, like 20?
Yeah, he was 20. Let's see. Right, but so there's a balance, of course.
Yep. 20.
Jeez. Like, he was very clearly not ready. And you can ruin guys that way.
So,
you have to strike a balance. Are there any guys you're like particularly happy with what they've done this year? Ken?
I've been very happy with Simeon Woods Richardson. Mm-hmm. Ultimately, I'm not sure if he's a starter or reliever, but he is like striking out like something like 40% of the hitters he's faced, and he's extremely young for the level. So that's always nice to see, even if you're skeptical about the results against more advanced hitters, you know?
Right. I mean, he's 18, and they put him in single A, which they would have never done that in the past.
No. Mm-hmm. And like they're basically using him as a reliever, but more like an opener, I guess. Mm-hmm. So they're still like managing his innings very closely. But yeah, he would have been in the he would still be in the complex right now, and probably would be looking to start in Kingsport if this was 2 years ago.
Yeah, I'm trying to think. Like, I mean, I guess Sapucky is a good parallel to. Similar age profile, et cetera. And they left him in the complex.
Yep.
For 3 months.
He probably didn't need to go to Brooklyn.
Nope.
Although, it's looking like it might not have mattered.
why do you have to depress us like this?
I'm a depressing person.
I mean, we were looking at a couple other parallel. There was the reliever parallel we had before. Who was the guy you were looking at?
Gilliam?
Yeah, right?
Yeah. He was the name I was also going to say, is that he just got promoted to AA. That would not have happened 2 years ago.
Right. I mean, the easy parallel is the Lions.
He's kind of the flip side of somebody who should be in AAA.
Right, exactly.
But isn't yet.
I think Adolph would have been... I really shouldn't just call him Adolph. That's unfortunate. Ross Adolph would have been a really good case study had they not traded him as to what they would do with these kind of players. Like advanced college bat, former Mets started him in Brooklyn for no reason, apparently. I would have liked to see what they did with him. I mean, we could look at Carlos Cortez, but I don't think that's particularly informative.
He's probably where he should be.
It's Carlos Cortez. We are not Carlos Cortez fans.
Mm-mm. I do find him very interesting for some reason.
I find the Mets' obsession with him very interesting.
Yeah, that's probably a better way to put it.
Because it's like this weird psychological puzzle we can't unpack.
He was way, way better as a prep. than he was as a college draftee.
Sophomore eligible draftee, right?
And they still, they still gave him $1 million.
I don't understand.
Yeah. We could talk about that all day.
Yeah. I mean, like, just as something that actually happened, like Quinn Brody, who isn't particularly good despite his 420 blaze at BABIP this year so far, though he is striking out less. But he, like, wasted a lot of time as an advanced college bat in single A versus Cortez. They've just thrown up higher. So it's encouraging.
Yeah. Would you say they've been better, if not quite where you want them to be? Is that a fair way to characterize this?
I'm trying to think of someone I've been displeased with where they put them so far this season.
Besides... podcast concern, Stephen Valines.
Yeah, I mean, that I at least understand because the AAA bullpen is crowded already, but I don't know if you guys have a name. I'm much less on the ball with the lower minors guys, which seems like where they might be making mistakes. Like, is there anybody they left in the complexes that probably shouldn't be there? No one comes to mind for me.
Yeah, same.
Let's see. I'm trying to think. Someone that is not on any roster that could be.
While Steve thinks of names.
The tall guy, but his name is not coming to me right now.
Is it Santos?
Yes, Junior Santos.
Oh,
they did promote him to Kingsport, and I mean, they brought him stateside, and he could have been, I think, challenged in Colombia. I mean, he is the same age and kind of level of experience as Woods Richardson.
I think the Kingsport and Brooklyn rosters are going to be the most interesting ones from this point of view.
I
saw Francisco Alvarez in the complex. It wasn't like a real look, but he looks like a 19-year-old. He's like a big, big, big dude. Like not tall, but like Wilson Ramos like came to mind. Just that kind of thick, you know?
Right.
I didn't really see him run at all. I don't know if he's quite as lead-footed, but, like, he's a big dude. I would think that he should be in Brooklyn this year. Mm-hmm. Just based on, you know, everything I've heard about him. And so that'll be interesting to see how that shakes out. He's still incredibly young. Junior Santos is another one that, you know, I'll be looking to see where they end up putting him.
Consuegra as well.
That's another good poll.
Ostadio, though, I mean, he's not as big a name, but I do want to see what they do with Ostadio.
Me too.
I mean, I think this is a discussion we have to revisit once the, like, in 2 months, yeah. 3 months, whenever those rosters come out, because that's like half the philosophy right there.
Yeah. I'll sum it up as basically being, we're happy with what we've seen so far, but the real determination is going to be when the short season rosters shake out.
Do you think that, you don't think they've been too aggressive or anything with, I mean, Mauricio's looked good. Newton was hurt, so we have no data. Vientos has also looked fine, so I guess they haven't been really too aggressive with any of those guys, which was probably the big risk of the decisions they've made so far.
Yeah, I think this is the test that Vientos needed, you know. Mm-hmm. I think if they put him in Brooklyn, it would have been more or less a retread of last year.
No, I agree with that.
It's up to him to perform in full season now. I don't think there's any process problem there. And he's looked fine. It's been rough, but he's basically been a league average hitter. The K rate's up a little bit, the walk's down a little bit, but again, it's what, 79 PAs?
He's not so overwhelmed that facing better competition is useless.
Yeah, right.
Right.
Like, I always say you want to play, I say this about not baseball, but other things, like you want to play someone who's better than you, but not so much better than you that you're just getting stomped.
Right. He's roughly the same age as Kelnick, who also ended up in the Sally this year, so.
Kelnick's killing it. Totally. Yeah. Secondary there, but.
He's looked real good.
I think
so
maybe.
So has Edwin Diaz.
Yeah, I'm not complaining.
We traded a very good prospect for very good big leaguers.
Yes. No complaint at all. I mean, I think you maybe could have made an argument for Newton since he struck out so much at the lower level, but. It's still fine. Like, it's an understandable decision.
Yeah, we're talking about, you know, I'd rather him get reps outside of the complex right now.
Yep.
You can always send him back to Brooklyn if he continues striking out at 50% of his plate appearances. Mm-hmm. To be clear, I don't expect that to continue.
That would be a pretty good indicator.
Hey, I mean, the Royals keep promoting games. The Royals keep promoting Sully Matias, or however you pronounce his name, so. Clearly, the strikeouts are only so much of a problem.
Well,
I'm going to check Matias' strikeout rate real quick here, just to add flavor to this discussion. 39. 39%. Yikes. After 35% last year at single A, promoted advanced A. He did hit 31 homers, though.
That is a bit excessive. All right. Well, I think a player with a very high strikeout rate is a good segue into, oh, yeah, that guy, because the player that I selected for this week is a guy that had a pretty high strikeout rate overall, although it's not that bad. But the guy selected was Adelin Rodriguez, who over the course of the last week of April in 2014 went 8-4-25 in 6 games, and he hit 4 home runs and had a very solid 320, 393, 840 line for the week. You know, bona fide 80 power and like a 70 arm, but that's pretty much all that Adelin was. And then once he got exposed to better pitching, he kind of got a lot of strikeouts, and that was the end of that. Basically hovered around 20% with a walk rate of like 5 or so, which is not going to really cut it. But he's actually still in organized ball, which is pretty crazy. Mets released him in 2015, and he's been with Baltimore pretty much for the last couple of years, and he's been okay. Mind you, he's been, like, way over the league average age, so he's not an age-level appropriate guy. But in 2016, he hit over 300, actually, for their high A team. In 2017, he hit 279 for their double A team. And then he repeated his time with Bowie in 2018 last year, and he hit 286. And he's currently hurt now, so he hasn't actually played, but he is rostered, and he's going to play in, for the Chihuahuas in the PCL. So, I mean, he might actually get an MLB call-up, which is kind of crazy.
I mean,
it's not like, you're not outlandishly crazy, but it is kind of crazy considering, you know, he was such a kind of one-dimensional player. And he's only 27. So, you know, the next couple, he could theoretically have a chance over the next couple of years, assuming that he does, like, okay.
Muncy.
You never know. Probably not, but you never know.
Did he ever play with, who was the third baseman prospect? He wound up on the Angels for a little bit. Jeffrey Marte? Is that who I'm thinking of?
Yes, yeah.
Did they ever play together?
I don't think so.
No? Okay. Thinking of a different corner infield duo, probably.
I feel like Marte was a long time ago. Although they are the same age, actually. Let's see. Did they play together? Yes, they did.
Oh, yes.
20... No, they didn't.
Damn it.
They're the same age, but they're a level apart.
Kind of vaguely. I mean, I vaguely remember being somewhat excited about both of them at some point years ago, but.
No, well, Marte made it to the majors, so.
I mean, hey, let's hope Adelin pulls it off too.
Yeah, why
keep
not?
Get that first hit. Keep that ball. Have it forever.
Be able to put that on his resume for the rest of his life.
I was a major league baseball player.
Yep.
I think both of us have pitchers, right, Ken?
Yes.
All right. You have a starter.
Yes.
You should start that.
Air quotes. Yeah. Okay. So my guy is that guy was a pitcher that the Mets found out of indie ball. In 2015, let me get his Fangraphs page up, Andrew Barbosa, who my friend Joe, who used to work for the Binghamton Mets, referred to as a 6'8" pirate who was too tall for his green screen. So that's fun.
His name is Barbosa. Pirate is a good name. So
exactly. I think he embraced the nickname too. On April 26th, 2016 for Binghamton. He threw 7.1 innings of two-run ball and struck out 10 against one walk. It's a pretty good day.
That's a good day.
Yep.
Yeah. He pitched reasonably well for Bingo that season. Let me pull that up. Yep. A 2.33 ERA against a – I don't have FIP up. A 2.33 ERA in 38.2 innings, striking out almost a batter an inning, 36 Ks again in 38.2 innings, and against 16 walks. So not a bad year for a 28-year-old journeyman reliever Eastern League.
Anytime a guy like that can get back into organized ball,
it's
always
massive.
Great for them. And then to have, you know, a pretty good season on top of that is icing on the cake.
Yep. An interesting tidbit I came across while researching this segment poorly is that he was a reserve for the Puerto Rican national baseball team that Seth Lugo was the ace of in the 2017 World Baseball.
Huh. I would have never guessed that.
Would have never guessed that.
Never in 100 years.
Yep. I don't know. I don't think he actually got into game action. I could be wrong about that. But, yeah, he was, like, on the roster.
Seth Lugo was too busy spin rating people to death.
Oh, he looked so nasty in those games.
He looked pretty nasty today, too.
He might just be very good, Lucas.
It might just be that when he's not sick, he's good.
Yeah.
Crazy idea, I know.
He might just be a very good reliever. He has spin rate on his side. Physics on his side, as I like to say.
Yeah. So my guy is also a pitcher. I pulled out Buddy Carlisle for this one. Really? One of the guys we get to put on the segment that had an actual major league career, or a larger than usual major league career. But at the start of 2014, Carlisle was still in the minors for the Mets, and over like 10-day stretch from the 17th to the 28th, he threw 6 1/3 innings of 1.42 ERA ball, 6 strikeouts. This was with AAA Vegas? 2014, they were in Vegas?
Yes.
Okay. I forget when they moved from North Carolina to Vegas. Was it North? Whatever. So Carlisle, of course.
Louisiana. Buffalo to Vegas. Mm-hmm.
Okay, right. So Carlisle, of course, did wind up on the Major League roster that year. It's a year when the Mets were showing some promise. I believe they actually finished above 500 in the second half. The pitching was starting to percolate up to the majors and look good. And after 33 innings in the minors, Carlisle came up and threw 31 major league innings. It was really good. He had a 1.45 ERA, a 2.65 FIP, struck out 8 per 9 innings, limited walks, limited home runs, like a cromulent setup guy. And then the Mets brought him back to start 2015. And I believe he's one of the first guys that Terry ran into the ground, overused, and got him hurt, and he never really pitched again, which is a shame. But in that 2014 season, kicked off by his strong April, he got up to the majors, had some significant time, got a hit in his one plate appearance too, and then got some money in 2015 before riding off into the sunset.
So his major league batting average is .001.
Let's see.
Well, for the Mets anyway, I guess.
For the Mets, yes. For
not his,
nope, that's not what I wanted. I want, Fangraphs, please don't do this to me,
Lucas. While you figure out the stats that you're looking for, my favorite Buddy Carlisle story is that he got the save on opening day of the 2015 season.
He
came in because Henry Mejia was hurt or something.
There was something. Was he suspended? No.
No, I think that might have been the first suspension out of two. Because I know the second one was around the trade deadline.
That might have been it, yeah.
But I think they called it an injury. I'm looking on Wikipedia, and it says he came in for an injured Henry Mejia.
Yeah,
Injured could be in air quotes there, who knows.
Injured? Yeah. That's
a thing that will always be true, is that Buddy Carlisle got a save on the first game of the 2015 National League pennant-winning Mets season.
That's pretty good to put on his mantle there. He does not have – so he was actually a starter when he first came up for the Braves, it looks like.
Mm-hmm.
That's the only way he pitched for the Padres, Dodgers, and then the Braves. So he got a little bit of time as a starter, hence his – career batting line is 175, 217, 175, but he does indeed have a 1,000, 1,000, 1,000, 497 weighted runs created plus line for the Mets.
Not bad.
I think I even remember that hit. I don't know why I can picture that hit in my head, but
it's always fun when relievers get a hit.
I could not tell you the game it happened in with the context of him hitting. I just remember him getting a hit. But yeah, that's the that guy.
I'm a fan of anybody whose first name is Buddy.
Buddy, yeah.
His actual name, or is it just a nickname?
No, his actual name is Earl Lester Buddy in quotes Carlisle. But
right, Buddy,
I think
he
made a good decision going.
Yeah,
no, I should have stuck with Earl.
Earl Carlisle sounds like the guy that is gonna pump your gas in Nowhereville, Tennessee.
Or I could picture it be like Earl Carlisle Esquire or something like that. One or the other.
Ooh.
I do vaguely remember him being something of a slack favorite, and then when Terry broke him, there was some anger.
When Terry broke him, he broke the hearts of slack.
Yes, there was some. Of course, we were never Terry's biggest fans in the first place, so perhaps we're a little bit biased there.
All right, well, does anybody have any last words for the week?
Edwin Diaz.
Observations, anything.
Edwin Diaz is so much fun to watch.
He is.
I want to see, you know, so someone was saying that Rich Hill was pitching in the complexes and just brutalizing people with his curveball, which I would have paid good money to see because I love watching flailing swings. I think they're hilarious. I want to see Edwin Diaz face, like, low A hitters. Just throw them.
Just blowing 98 by, like,
no fastball.
17-year-old kids.
Only sliders. I just want them to try to hit one of his sliders. I would pay money to watch this.
That would be fun.
It'd be hilarious.
Anyone has any questions, comments, whatever, send us an email at our email address, which is fromcomplextoqueens@gmail.com. Or you could follow us on Twitter and then shoot us questions there. I'm at Steve Saipa. Lucas is at ElVlahos343. And Kenny is at KenLavin91. And of course, if you haven't already done so, but you're still somehow listening, subscribe to the podcast and rate and review it from wherever you get your podcast from. And thank you for listening. And we will be back next week with a recap of the fourth week of the 2019 minor league season.
My name is Spencer Hall.
My name is Jason Kirk.
My name is Ryan Nanny.
And when we combine, we form
the Shutdown Fullcast.
Voltron!
I keep telling you, we're not Voltron.
The Shutdown Fullcast is technically a college football podcast, but it's also a show about
lawn care disasters,
regional grocery stores we love,
Tennessee Batman,
homeowners associations,
bears and video games,
Pittsburgh Batman,
the hell of being trapped in a group text,
unreliable legal advice.
I mean, there's also some actual football discussion, like about coaches having huge contracts, or coaches making terrible decisions, or coaches saying really stupid things.
Or the NCAA saying really stupid things.
Yeah, there's lots of stupid things in this big, dumb, beautiful sport.
Like the time Arkansas decided to use a captured feral hog as a mascot, and it escaped, and it wound up killing 7 rattlesnakes, a pig, and a coyote.
Sometimes we talk about football games.
Allegedly.
If you want to take college football exactly as seriously as it deserves to be taken, come find us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever else you listen to podcasts like this one.
The Shutdown Fullcast.
It's not Voltron.
Unless it is.
Damn it.